On this episode of the Fieldhouse Files, you'll hear my interview with former Pacer C.J. Miles as we first talked about the unrest and negativity in the country, then had fun going back in time to discuss his three seasons with the Pacers, how he had the late Jerry Sloan and Larry Bird in his corner, how he was a great teammate, and what Indy means to him.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so good. So I just finished my dinner. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
And welcome into another episode of the Fieldhouse Files. I'm Scott Agnes. Well, C.J. Miles is one of the most memorable players to play in Indiana this decade. He first was drafted by the Jazz as a teenager out of high school back in 2005 and later signed with the Pacers in 2014 after two seasons in Cleveland. It was the year Paul George suffered a compound fracture, but throughout his time with the Pacers, Miles did whatever they needed, whatever they asked of him. And while statistics don't necessarily define his game really at all, it is notable, however, that his top scoring average in his NBA career was in year one with the Blue and Gold when he averaged 13.5 points per game. During those 3 years, he became close with George Hill and Jan Mahimi, and despite being on separate teams now, they spend the offseason together in Texas. And Miles, of course, was one of the best quotes during his tenure with the Pacers. Full disclosure now, this interview was recorded last month. It was actually the night before the Athletic had layoffs, and I was part of it, hence the delay in finally sharing it with all of you. But in the meantime, I do want to express my gratitude for you listeners and readers out there, and I just ask that you make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on whichever media platform you listen to, and consider taking an extra minute to leave a review for me on Apple Podcasts. All right, as promised, bringing in one of the fan favorites here recently for the Indiana Pacers, at C.J. Miles, who's with his daughter Ava, enjoying what they can for right now. But C.J., before I get into kind of the fun stuff through your career and going straight to the NBA, those sorts of things, I think it's important to discuss kind of what's happening in our world, in our communities, and everything. So I guess I'll start by saying, how you doing? And share with me what's on your heart right now. What would you like to start with?
It's hard, man, because where we at now, like, you got a lot of people who've been through a lot of things, who've been hurt, who've been lied to, who've been given hope for things to change and do certain things, and it hasn't happened. And then on top of that, the same things are happening. And I'm one of those people, like, I understand, but at the same time, I just ask people to, like, to value their life. That's my biggest thing that I've been talking to about my people that I know that have been out there, or friends I've talked to that are thinking about doing things. Just know, and valuing your life is not a black or white thing. That's everybody in general, because that would get us to the point that we're trying to get to. Everybody valuing another person's life and their own in a certain way. And right now, that's my biggest thing with the people that are protesting and peacefully protesting and doing certain things. It's just, you know what's getting people hurt in the streets right now. And if you want to make a change, I don't know if doing something that is going to get you in a bad position is going to help the change. One, you won't see it. One, your family is now a part of the rage people that are out in the streets. Like, we're putting ourselves, and this is not to the people that are doing it the right way. I'm speaking on the people that are out there taking advantage of the situation. Yeah. They're putting people that are doing it the right way in danger, because the people that are getting hit and getting shot at and things like those are most of those people are the people trying to do it the right way. It's just the rage that's being created around them. Obviously, you know, it's going to feed into everything, because it's one big crowd to the people who also feel like that they're trying to protect themselves too. And there's a lot, you know, and we know what it is. Everybody does. That's the thing. That's the killer that I think for people, especially right now in this very moment, we watched a man be murdered. Mm-hmm. And that's not just black people. Everybody watched that man be murdered. Like, that's the problem. The evidence in front of a bunch of people, including myself, shows you that it is not something that he did besides his skin color that's leading to that end result. And that's the thing. Like, that's where everybody, at least that I know and myself, have been in situations. I've been in like, and that's the thing too. Like, it's at a point now where there's no more of that. Those guys that are like us that make it to the NBA or become professional athletes, and you feel like they're out of touch with it. And that's not the case, because it's happening everywhere and to anybody that looks like me.
The biggest concern for me moving forward right now, I think, CJ, is the fact that a lot of angst, like there's so much negativity in the world just in general. And I think, and I'm talking even going back to COVID, and now what do you have, 40 million lost jobs? Then you have this, which is a productive conversation. But I think all of it as a collective is there's just so much anger and angst about everything. And so one little thing is sparking rather than conversation, a lot of times is sparking disagreement. I even think we saw that here in the recent days, especially.
Yeah, it's wild because they talk about how people feel like history repeats itself. And a lot of times, you know, but that's because we've been doing, like, we're a community that fears wisdom. Like, everybody knows everything, but nobody wants to apply it to every day. So, like, plenty of people knew the things that have been going on in our country, and that's besides the police brutality that black people feel. There's a lot of things that we know, and we just been kind of living and just letting it go. It's like, it is what it is type of thing. And the famous quote is, you know, any type of injustice is, you know, injustice to everything. It's a slippery slope.
I'm curious, did you know Chris Beatty at all? I'm not sure if the news has gotten to you either. He was a local club promoter, worked at clubs around town here, and he was shot while he was trying to save a couple people in downtown Indy over the weekend, for example.
I did not know him.
Okay. I figured you might, just because, you know, a lot of guys, like, George Hill, like, all those guys knew him.
I didn't know him.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like somebody, I definitely knew someone that did, probably. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But it's just a wild thing. It's a sad thing, man. It's sad for people that are disconnected and don't understand, and they're trying to understand, and they're being, and because of all the angst and the rage, some of those people are being met with rage, and they're picking a side that they really don't want to pick. And then at the same time, there's people that are downright evil in our world that are just, because this, it isn't in my, this is the last thing I'll say about it, because I don't want to spend the whole time talking about it, because
you could go on for hours about this.
Yeah, exactly. And
this is worthwhile, like, of
in
a
my
conversation.
Mind, at this point, I don't see, it's not a flesh and blood battle. Like, it's deeper than that now, because it's been going on for so long. So it's not like people dying and us killing each other is not solving anything. It's never going to at this point, because we've been doing that. Like, and that's proven to keep us in this circle. And that's not saying people should protect themselves. That's a different story. But what I'm saying is, it's a deeper situation in some places where something is being taught that's allowing people to literally hate someone for no reason at all. That's like the deepest case of it. That's the stem of it, the root of it, that has been taught from a time, a long, long time ago, that was supposed to be over, and the mindset was still carried into a modern time, and then another modern time. And then you got kids who thought that the end goal was to see a black president, a person in power, would be something that would help change it. And these kids have seen this for 20 years, let's say. They're the kids that saw the greatest feat that they thought from a civil rights type of thing, and nothing changed. So of course you tip. Like, because I got that, and then I don't have a job. Then I can't make no money. Then I can't go outside. Then I can't, like, it was a weight that was just, somebody was bound to just not want to carry it anymore.
Yeah, and because of all that, that's where I'm really trying to have empathy for others. And it all goes back to everybody's dealing with something right now. And it feels like right now, everybody's dealing with a lot on their plate, whether it's emotionally or physically, or they don't have jobs or what have you. You and Lauren, your wife, obviously considered maybe what it would be like having conversations maybe with Ava, your daughter, down the road in 10, 15 years about all of this.
It's wild, though. It's wild. It's wild. Especially, and then her sister that's about to be born in the next 2-3 weeks, like in the midst of this, like, but my biggest thing is that to do what I've always done, which is to carry myself in a manner that would allow us to continue to bring change through action also, not just to be talking. Like I have taken pride in that and what I was taught and what I would like to be taught and how I would like myself and my family to be treated and to treat people as such. And I think that's where it all starts until we all realize that somebody's got something on their plate. If that's never on your mind,
yeah,
we're never gonna be able to get past that. Like we're never gonna be able to have enough empathy for people to ever want to have a real conversation. Like everybody's so mad about things that have been done in the past and things that are like the cycle continuing that it must be this way. There's so many people that have been living this way for so long and know nothing else. Like, and now you're charging the system from both sides. Like they look at us, like they look at black people, like they're charging the system. And then at the same time, on the other side, we look like they disrespected it because they passed laws and amendments and rules that were supposed to stop it. Like, think about the fact that I'm losing my mind on the word, but they put out a report for the police and like the new rules, I say that they were going to have to abide by to be in the streets. And the first thing it said was, if a police officer sees someone doing misconduct, they have to intervene.
Oh,
why
right.
is that? Why is that just now on the list?
Yeah, up in Minneapolis, that was among the changes. It's like, yes, that's a
why
given.
Is that a change? I thought that was the first job anyway.
Yeah,
protect and serve.
Right, and for me, it kind of goes along and with we're seeing teams put out statements and individuals and. And I'm going back in my mind, I understand that, and it's probably the right thing to do, CJ, but I'm also thinking, well, duh, like, condoning,
yeah.
like, you
yeah.
shouldn't have to say that, because yeah. it should be understood, but I get yeah. why teams are having
yeah.
to do that.
Me and my wife had a conversation about that, about, like, people that we know, and friends that we have, and people that we come in contact with, and, like, people ask us how do we feel if we don't see them post, or, in my mind, the people that I know, they don't have to prove that to me. It's not, they don't have to prove mm-hmm. it to me. I don't, it doesn't feel that type of way. Now them going out to their way to do that and encourage other people and spread and magnify, which is what we're trying to do with that stuff, is the reason why I think people want people to post. But like, I don't even look for my friends to see if they, I didn't even think to do that because I know where they stand. Like these are people that have been in my house. Our kids play together. Yeah. We've been friends for years. Like I don't even, like, my mindset isn't ever in that manner if I wonder if they really like me or not. Like, I've never had that feeling with any of the people of my, any of my friends that aren't black.
And so that's like, where that negative thought of these last few months creeps in, is everybody assumes the worst. Or some yeah. are assuming the worst, I should say.
And that's people, and that's, that lets you know how big the majority of people
yeah.
who have never had a positive contact with somebody outside of their race is. And that's wild to even think about.
Yeah.
There's somebody who's 18 years old who's never had an interaction with a person outside of their race that's been positive. And that's sad. Right and wrong is only as strong as what you know. That's really the thing. Like people that are taught racism, like they think they're right. They don't know. They live with a bunch of other people that are racist. There's no people of color around them that's on purpose.
And that's why it's good to experience different things. And for
exactly.
me,
that's
for
why.
Me, I don't think anything about it. I my high school is probably, I don't know, 40% black. So to me, I don't even think about it.
Exactly. That's because you know.
I was around it. Yeah.
You've been
and
around
appreciated
it. Like, there's a real
it
cutoff.
Embraced it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a real cutoff and a real disconnect. There's kids and this is not, I'm not saying this is a fault to them. There's just, it's their life that they were born into, just like the people right. that have been born into their situations have. The things that we're dealing with, which is why we need to be able to find ways to connect with coaches. But there's a kid somewhere, like I said, that's 18, has never had a positive interaction with a person outside of his race. There's another kid that's 18 about to go to an Ivy League school that was born into money and has never been around people. He just doesn't know. He only knows everything is taught. Every single thing that a power person, like a child doesn't register fear until we teach it. They don't register being sad. They know how to exert an emotion when they're at half. They laugh and they cry. And everything else until we start to teach from watching, from context clues, from everything. So if you've never seen someone interact with a person outside of your race, you walk a different way. And it's because it's all you know.
And that's where experience in whatever you're talking about is
yes.
so critically important in all that. I'll admit it's awkward. There's no easy transition from that subject. I mean, there's no
that's
way
why
around
I tried
it.
To stop when I tried to stop. Like.
I'll try to do the best I can, but transitioning to something.
We good.
To a more fun conversation. I figured
this is what it's for. This is why
absolutely.
Everything's happening for us to do this right now. So I'm good. I'm thankful and I'm grateful for you even calling me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like I said, I mean, a real conversation like this probably deserves several hours. It can't be accomplished in 15 minutes or 45 minutes. But it is a start, opening people's eyes and
dialogue
ears to all that.
Dialogue is all you want.
Yeah, and that's where it needs to be productive. People listen. And that's mainly what I've tried to do is shut up, be mute, listen, and take it all in. Because there's stuff even I'll never be able to experience certain things. But let's make that awkward transition, I guess, now. I think I'll start maybe in high school. And for one, CJ, I always loved it when you were introduced because I think you have one of the great high school names from Skyline High School. And I looked it up, the Raiders. Looking back, you're McDonald's All-American, top 20 recruit, but you were that last group, did not go to college. When you look back at that time, how seriously did you consider going, I think, to the University of Texas? And do you feel like you were better off because of it, because you were able to go straight to the league?
So the wildest thing about it is I had no intentions of going into the league until the deadline of the draft to leave your name in.
Okay.
Like, I didn't even know it was a possibility for real until the end of my senior basketball season. Like, I had no idea that there were scouts and people asking for film and all these things. My parents and my high school coach kept it from me. They just let me be a kid. They let me play basketball. They let me do my schoolwork. They let me make my school decision. They let me do all of that. And I was thankful for that because I didn't lose that moment in time to something that might or might not happen.
And that's really awesome because I think about kids today. What do you imagine your life would be like if you're getting
that was my next point.
Yeah.
Because there was no crazy social media platform and all that, I was able to not hear all the word on the street about whatever's going on all the time. Like, there was nobody to pump my head from outside of my home with rumors of this and that. You know, you can get this, or you can get paid like this, or you can do this, or you can do that. Like, you know what I mean? There's no influence of that type of nature like that. Don't get me wrong. The message boards and stuff are starting at that time.
Yeah.
And there's rankings, but that's the extent of it. There's just articles about kids going to college because there's not a lot of kids doing that anyway, making the jump no more. Not successfully. Not a lot. Like, there's a couple that stick. You know what I mean?
Right.
LeBron that just did it, obviously, but that's another story. Like, that's another world of situation. And then I did some workouts after my senior year, and everything went fast. I remember prom, and I remember being at Summer League in Salt Lake. Like,
that's incredible. And I look back at your class and the type of guys. For one of your best friends, John Mahimi's in that class, which I totally forgot about.
Though. Funny story. So, like, the Spurs are one of the teams that we thought was going to pick me. It was them, Utah, and, like, another team that I kind of had. We had a really good feel about. And when they drafted Yum, obviously I was like, what the hell is Yum? Like, you know what I mean? Like, because I'm a Texas kid at the time, you know? So, like, to be able to go to San Antonio to play, obviously it's the Spurs, and be at home in the NBA, even close to home. And then I was going to Austin. So, like, it was the same thing, basically. Like,
is that a pressure you would have liked, though?
I think the pressure in the actual city, I wouldn't have liked.
Okay.
In actual Dallas, like, I don't think I would have liked it. Because I think just leaving my neighborhood and going right to the American Airlines Center would not, like, it would be too many hands out and people reaching to grab and wanting to be around and, like, your sense of loyalty.
Yep. That's what I saw with George Hill. It's what I saw with Jeff Teague. And I don't think most players want that as much as fans kind of clamor for it.
And they were older and they didn't like it as much. Like, think about being 17 when you got to say yeah to everybody you feel like, because everybody's older.
And you don't know any better.
Yeah, you don't know nothing. You're just like, this is what it's for. And it is part of the reason why you grind so hard, because you want to be able to do certain things for your people and help and change things. But people will take and take and take and take. And it's not a good situation to feel like you win.
Can you detail kind of what that's like just in general for an NBA player? Just everybody, I mean, it includes media requesting interviews and people wanting money and, hey, can you buy me a cell phone? Hey, can I get a car?
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain people you want to take care of, but it has to add up.
Yeah, 100%. Like, And then they don't realize, like, you get drafted, they think it's $1 million in your pocket to go get drafted also. Like, that's not the way it works. Especially, I was a second round pick. I didn't make $1 million in my first 2 years. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and that's just adding up before taxes are taken out, before agent fees, before my player fees, before I get an apartment to stay in, before I help my mom out with all the bills and everything and whatever we got. Like, now I'm stuck at, like, trying to just scrape up to save that first out of that first check and stuff.
Curious, because you also spent time in the G League, but you come across anybody that's heard you super confident, very comfortable in your own skin. Have you always been that way?
Nah. Not at all. Actually.
When was that transition then?
I built my armor in the league. I had to.
Okay.
Because when being as young as I was and the type of person I am or was as far as like wanting to make sure that I made like I'm a pleasing person. Like I wanted to make not everybody to like me, but I want everybody to be good. So
you want to raise all tides. I saw that. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, so I think I used to suffer with if I felt like my teammates or the fans, like I wasn't pulling my weight. I wasn't doing my job because I worked extremely hard. And that was the thing I always wanted. I wanted to make people to know that I was grateful for the chance that I got because I knew how rare it is. And I feel like that every year I've been in the league. But like my biggest thing is like I wanted to be able to never let anyone down. Like it wasn't so much about me. Like if my job was to make this shot or that play or that crackback or that rebound or whatever, and I feel like that you're gonna miss some obviously, but I was consistently doing it, that hurt me. And I went through a lot of things early in my career because of that mentally. Because I was fighting a battle of trying to prove myself to get enough minutes to be able to do what I felt like people wanted from me. And at the same time, trying to figure out how to actually do it. Like,
yeah.
And that was the hard part.
What is the pressure like being in a contract here? Or coming off a big contract and doing what you just said, having to prove it, you're worth that value.
It's in a contract year, it's a hard thing because it's a team sport and it's still a business. So you have to find a line of a tad aggressive to make sure you showcase the things you continue to bring for your team within being the scheme of the team.
Yep.
Because you have to do what you do and you have to do it well and you have to showcase that. And you have to do that every year, but like the contract year puts weight on it because we know how sports go. You're as good as your last game. There's plenty of guys who've been on 3-year contracts and been terrible for 2 years and played 1 year good and got another 4-year deal off.
Oh, yes.
That's no disrespect. It's just the way it is. Like it's happened. Because now you're giving them a vision of they can only go off of what you just gave them and what they think you'll fit the next year. Like that's just the way that's the way it goes. That's how we play it. So you know there's some pressure on it, and you've seen guys' games change in that last year. You've seen them like maybe even mess up their careers over them.
And the thing that stands out to me and all that is a guy like yourself, I envision you're a guy that's strictly not the numbers. You're the selfish guy in the locker room. You're the guy doing whatever the coach asks. You're the guy doing things away from the ball, which aren't tangible numbers, which don't show up in the box score. So if a basic fan tries to equate value with stats, it just doesn't work, I think, for a player like yourself.
And that's, I think, my knowledge of self is what really cured all of that. Okay. Like knowing who I am and what I do and what I can do and what I'm supposed to do. And then at the same time, as I got older I'm so hard on myself. And then you start to get to a point where you start to actually think about the things you actually done. And I told somebody this recently, like, if I really want to be real about it from a hooping standpoint, like just playing basketball, I had two people solidify me as a basketball player that should never let nobody outside of the game hinder my thoughts. I had Jerry Sloan and I had Larry Bird sit in front of me at a table and tell me that I deserve to be on their team. I don't really need a lot of validation from nobody else, like, that don't do what I do. You know what I mean?
Completely. Yeah, when you have those guys speaking up for you.
Exactly.
Two Hall of Famers.
I've been around two of the greatest people to ever touch this game. So, and I think if them people who don't lie, we know, who don't hold their tongue, neither one of them held their tongue about the good or the bad with me. Larry Bird sat in the gym and watched me work out for a whole summer, a whole offseason. Every day, it was just me and Mike. And Larry Bird, he would work out. He would do his little run on a, or elliptical, whatever. He would pull his hair up. He would sit right at half court every morning. I stayed in downtown Indianapolis, and he was in the gym every day. And for him to do that was another thing for me, too. It let me know how much he respected the amount of work that I did.
How rare is that to get straight-up candor from an executive, from a head coach, the kind of info that you want?
Forget the executive and head coach, from the legend, from Larry Legend. Like, for me, it's the basketball. I don't even care. I'm not going to say I don't care about it, but, like, that's what the weight is for me.
Sure.
Because this is the person that I looked up to as the game. Watch NBA classes to see the games. I studied him as a player. Like, this is what I took from that. So, like, his respect from that is enough. And then all of a sudden, his basketball mind and everything he did after that is being a coach, being coach of the year one year, having a great team, lets you know how his mind transcends in the game, because a lot of guys are really good players and can't coach.
Then how much, I'm curious, did this influence your time with the Pacers in terms of coming here and being with the roster?
I like the team already. Obviously, he definitely put icing on the cake when he sat at the table. It was crazy because we sat down, and it was really simple. Like, I came to Indiana with my agent. We sat down at Capitol Grill downtown.
Standard.
And he you know, they bring the potato chips out. He picked the whole thing up. He's eating them like it's like closer to him. He's eating them like he's just popping them like we in a backyard somewhere. He was like, I really don't want to even talk about all that number stuff. I watch guys play. I watch enough basketball. I've seen you play. I feel like you can play. I know you can play. You can help us. And he didn't really have to say much after that to me. And, of course, we talked about everything after that because I knew where I was coming to, too. I had played against this team. They were the best team in the East the year before. They murdered everybody for a couple of years now. I'd seen the growth. And I felt like what I did helped that team off the bench. And then, of course, the roster changes and Paul getting hurt and everything changed a little bit. But then that brought more out of me, too, because that year me and George Hill had to do things that we wouldn't have been asked to do.
Yeah, you came in after they made back-to-back appearances in the Eastern Conference Finals. Exactly. Your first year with the Pacers is Paul's injury there. Is that really where your bond with G. Hill started, having to come together, or was it just your personalities meshed so well?
It was just a lot. It was mostly personality. And those are the first guys that I got. Because, like, even though I was younger, I was in my 20s, but I was still, like, you know, I was the youngest person on my team in Utah for the longest time. Even when I got to year 7, I'm 24 going on 25. Like, and then I got called a vet for the first time for real in Cleveland. And I felt like this is my first step outside of Utah. I'm really still figuring it out. I had just had the number of years, but, like, if I went to college and came out, it would be my third year.
Yeah.
It's my fourth year. Like, you know what I mean? And it was looked at different because now it's my eighth. It's my seventh. It's my eighth. And when I got to Indiana, I felt like that's when that knowledge itself really I had figured it out. And him and Jan were people around the same age. They're also coincidence. Their wives now were both from Texas. My girlfriend, who I got engaged to in Indiana, was from Texas. So they got along. So even if we didn't like each other, we didn't have a choice anyway. we just kind of linked, and that we respected each other's work ethic and everything else to the point where we lived 10 minutes from each other in San Antonio. Like,
and that's where you off season together. That's where what I love about it.
And this is after not being on the same team for 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. That's where those relationships never end, which is awesome to see. Did you realize in Cleveland that you were kind of known as a Pacers killer? Did you realize that?
No, I knew I had some really good games. Like, yeah. I was aware of that for that team. Because it was one of those gyms, if I was struggling a little bit for a couple games and I saw that on the schedule, I knew I was coming out of it that night. Even though that doesn't make sense, it's a mental thing, obviously. But it was easier to come out of it that night because I had a history of shooting well and playing well in that gym. And it always brought it out. And I knew Lance didn't like to chase people around screens. So,
yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't like to guard him dancing with the ball either. So,
mm-hmm. It's fascinating when Lance is here because it's always entertaining. It's never dull around here. I thought we were very close about to get him again this year. And I was like, ooh, really? Is the third time going to be the charm? After he went away after a couple years.
I thought the second time he wasn't going anywhere again.
I didn't either, but this time at least I couldn't blame him in that. I mean, the opportunity to play, he is Hollywood, to play with LeBron and have a chance at a ring, that enticed you a little bit. So I didn't blame him as much. The first time was a whole debacle.
The first time was wild because they thought my signing would hinder him coming back, that I was told by people that knew. And that was kind of why he kind of felt like they were moving on, because they thought he was going to get paid too much, which wasn't the case. Like, I was always intended to come off the bench. They told me that at the meeting that I had, that they were trying to bring Lance back. The year he left the first time.
Yep.
At my meeting, they told me they were bringing Lance back. So, I didn't come there thinking I was taking his spot. And I thought some people that talked to me and thought that that was a miscommunication that they thought happened.
Yeah, and this is where, in my mind, Larry set a fine number for Lance, told him we're not going to go any higher, and both his agent and dad thought, no, you're worth more than that. So he turned down $44 million guaranteed. And if I remember right, he still hasn't made that up in the years since and is currently out of the league. So that's where you talk about listening to others and bad advice. In my mind, that's certainly the problem there, and I was surprised.
Like, one of the things that I've had the same agent my whole career, Billy Sasha. One of the things that, I'm not going to talk like I've been getting offered $50 million at a time and things like that. But, one of the things still in my realm of the deals that I've gotten, we never made a decision solely off money, ever. Like, it would have to be a drastically, it would have to be $10 million difference or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I don't think that was the case.
I don't live a lifestyle where I'm solely dependent on – like, that's what I'm after all the time. But I'm not going to say I would be stupid and turn down money. But, I mean, when it's close and it's, give or take a reasonable amount, I'm not going to try to squeeze out more to get to a place that just because of the money. We always dissect everything by how it's going to fit and how the organization made you feel, because I got to be happy. I got to have some type of motivation to want to be in that gym every day. If it don't matter how much I love basketball, if the organization and the situation is toxic.
That is real,
for
man.
Me, if yeah. it's toxic for me, it might not be toxic for everybody, but if it don't work for me, then I can't give you what you want from me. So now we got another problem, because now you feel like I'm getting over. You might feel like I just don't care no more and I just can't figure it out.
Yeah.
And then it's a disconnect with the fans. Then it's a disconnect with the front office. And that's how stuff happens. And that's why I always wanted to make sure that I looked at it mentally and physically.
Money has to be a big factor, but not the only factor, obviously. Yeah. But, and this is where, in his case specifically, you have to value fit and where you're appreciated. Larry, a couple of years before that, with I think both Paul and Danny Granger, I remember this, where he was in the best locker room, says, our best, most talented player is Lance Stephenson. And this was before he even broke out. So you had a guy that believed in you. Anyway, enough about Lance. I wanted to get back to you, even though that's another fun conversation, including his battles and a contract year with Evan Turner, those sorts of things. those are the things you laugh about years later. But I guess this year, how difficult has it been for you basketball-wise in terms of you got traded to a team that had no playoff hopes realistically, and more than anything, individually, you had health issues where you needed surgery, and then you're off the team and away from basketball. That seems like such a mental hurdle more than anything.
It's been wild, but I always try to look at everything for everything that it could be and can be. The one of the things that – I haven't been away from basketball, not played a game this long probably since I was 4 years old. You know what I mean? This is something I've been doing my entire life, and this is the first time. I had two surgeries in a season. In a year. And they were minor, but they were things that had to heal. I had to let them – I'm fine. I've been rehabbing, and I'm working out, and I'm going to be fine. But it was just terrible timing.
And then to have your craft taken away from you.
Yeah, that's what I was, and it was hard mentally because now, there's a space. There's a big space that it's different when you're ready to go. You know what I mean? When you're ready to not be around it, but I'm not. Never was. So, it was taken. It wasn't like I walked away and was looking for something to fill it. It was just snatched from under my feet, it felt like. And then it happened again when I came back. And mentally, I this is why I encourage guys to have things away from the floor, hobby-wise, any type of thing that you have interest in, and whether it make you money or not. I'm not saying go waste money on it, but things that make you happy, that keep you sane,
because I had to lean on, I'm a reader, I'm a writer, I'm a creator. So I had to lean on that more than ever to keep myself from, you know, I had to put that energy somewhere. Because if you keep it inside, it'll eat you alive.
Has it been a lot of music and reading for you?
Yeah, music, reading, writing, and obviously my daughter,
absolutely, my wife.
Like, being home as much as I've been able to be has been a blessing, because we're pregnant. We're about to have another kid. And the beginning of the pregnancy was tough, but I got to be home every day. My wife wasn't feeling well. It was not like life threatening tough, but just tough on her physically, getting, you know, prepared to make a life. Yeah. So me being home with a terrible 2-year-old to help every day was amazing. And then in the end of it, when the way the league stopped, when everything, the pandemic broke out and everything, I was home already. I wasn't traveling around. I wasn't running around worried about if I was bringing that back to my wife, because I had to go to work. Like, I didn't have that on my mind. I remember talking to Fred Van Fleet when they were getting tested. I literally was outside washing my car.
Okay.
Like, not to make light of what was going on, but I'm just saying, like, I got to be already kind of away. And I didn't have that scare. I didn't have that worry. And that scared me for a bunch of people that I knew, especially for guys in the league in general, but especially the ones I know, because I know they have kids. I know they have a wife. I know their kids. I know their wife. And for that to have to affect them is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, I know a player right now, it's not public, but he got the virus from his daughter, who got it from their nanny. And those are the circumstances I don't think a lot of people know about or even consider. There's like, hey, yeah, go do your job. That's what you're paid to do. And it's way more complex than that, than people get
like,
into.
That's a thing that I feel like sometimes gets disrespected. Sometimes. Some people, and a lot of people get it more because social media has allowed us to be more open about our lives and our families and making it more relatable to. But the money disconnect is always a thing, because we live in a country where a lot of people don't have money. So they feel like if you make money, it should be no problem to do whatever it is to make money, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's always that judgment and the comparison.
Yeah, and I don't think that's fair at all. Like, I mean, and it makes light of the amount of work that had to be done to get to the position in the first place, I feel like sometimes. But I think, because of the state of the world that we live in and disconnect the money with that, when, because they publicize the contracts, they publicize how much you make, because that's part of the thing that keeps fans riled up too, because it's conversation. And
that's where fans have moved towards now. They care more about the transaction game. I think it provides the hope. That's what I've always said. It provides hope, whereas if your team is no good right now, you can look ahead.
Yeah, and then we get a guy that they feel like is worth $100 million. He must be good. He must be able to help us. And I get it. Like I said, I understand. Like, I understand the whole thing. I know it's a business. I understand the way the whole thing works. It's just sometimes it feels like, as a guy in the league, if another guy was in your position averaging the same 10 points, shooting whatever from whatever, it wouldn't matter. And that kind of, and in certain situations, that does not feel good, because you work extremely hard to be in the platform you are.
You're talking about life after basketball. How about our boy G Hill going off and getting himself a ranch? There's that story in ESPN detailing that. But one that doesn't exactly surprise me. He's always been kind of a country boy at heart, loves country 100%. Music, those sorts of things. But this was a bold move. I know, like, when he was here, he talked about he was fed up that there was no bait and tackle shops in Geist, where he and Paul George live. So I remember talking with him. He was like, yeah, man, I'm thinking about building one or launching my own place. Never did that. But did you have these conversations with him as he was
I knew about the ranch. I knew the ranch thing was coming, because we've been in Texas during the summer. So, like, we had been talking about it. And I was around when he first bought it. And it's just like a piece of Wakanda out there. So it's like this big, massive piece of land that it's like it appeared out of nowhere. Like, it's so untouched. Like, it's hard to find that, you know, a lot of places. But Texas is one of the places that has some really great, lush hill country spots. And he's living his dream out there. Like, he loves it. Like, it's like what I'm talking about. It's a peace of mind for him. Like, and this is something that'll continue to be peace of mind even when basketball's gone. And it's wealth to pass down to your children, trade to pass down to your children, things you have to be taught. And that's another thing that goes into being a role model and a leader of your home, like equipping people with skills that they can use in case of anything happening.
I was always surprised when we talk about current events in terms of sports, and George was like, dude, I don't watch the Super Bowl. I don't really like sports.
Yeah.
I much rather go play in the these kids, I don't even know what they're called, but like where they're throwing balls and little things like this and jump around.
Yeah.
He much rather be that kid at heart than watch the Super Bowl or watch the Final Four. And that was always fascinating to me because he was a professional basketball player.
Yeah, he's a great dude, man. Yeah. He's a great father, great husband. It's been amazing to know him in the league, because you meet a lot of guys, and like, I don't mean to talk bad about, but you meet people that you just don't click with. Your views aren't the same. I shouldn't say views, but y'all just don't see things in a manner that you can understand personally. Y'all can figure out how to work together.
Yeah.
And then there's guys that might just hate you, and you might not like him, and there's all these things, and then you make friends, but they kind of only stick as far as the season goes. But to be able to meet these people and be deeply rooted with them and know them personally and be able to work with them, it makes basketball that much better. You know what I mean? Because it's another one of the things that it's given you. Like, it took us to London, it took us to all these different places. It let us meet all these people. It allowed us to help all these people. And I think that's the greatest thing for me at the end of my career now, like, that I think about, is all the stuff I've been able to do besides that. Because it started off with just for me, because I wanted to play basketball.
As that simple was as that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. Like, I love to play basketball. And it's still like that. But now I know everything that comes with it, and it makes the hard work even better, because the hard work is what got me to a place to be able to do it.
Do you envision you'll remain in basketball in some capacity afterward? Because I could see you, if you wanted, to be some kind of executive or scout, because your eye for talent and building relationships, you could do a player relations role, or you would obviously be excellent TV, radio in the broadcast realm.
So the broadcasting thing, we talk about it all the time. My thing right now is, like, I think when I actually am ready to stop playing, I don't know if I want to keep the same schedule that I'll have. You know what I mean? I would want to take that time to be able to live, like, in a space where I don't have to worry. Obviously, I'm not a person that can sit, but, like, to have a space where I'm kind of like, this is happening. That's cool. I might try that. You know what I mean? Like, not really have to be in a schedule type of mindset. But I want to coach. I don't know if I want to coach in the NBA, because it's the same thing. Like I said, I don't know if I want that schedule with my kids, with having young kids. But we'll see. You never know. Like, I want to be involved in the game. I think I've learned a lot. I picked a lot of basketball minds. I played a lot of basketball. I've developed a way to be able to communicate with people. And that's one of the things that I think that why I've gotten people ask me about if I want to coach, because that's a skill that I've sharpened, because I wanted to be able to. Because that's one of the things that I'm passionate about, is not to go back to what we talked about in the beginning, but mending these bridges. And you can't do that if you can't communicate with different people. Which means you got to learn, you got to listen, you got to listen and learn. And that's what anybody in any type of situation.
Did you feel like during your time in Indy, one of my biggest takeaways was that season where you were basically playing. Oh, there we get live action with Ava. I love it.
Hold on. Daddy's almost done. I promise.
I love it. Last couple things.
Can you say hi?
Hi.
Hi, Ava.
Say, how are you?
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Say, I'm doing good.
I'm doing good.
Say, I just finished my dinner.
And that's what it's all about right there. I
say,
love
talk
it.
To you later.
I get it later.
Okay.
All right.
See you,
I'll come
Ava.
Get you in a little bit, okay?
Okay.
All right. Go get mommy.
Lauren's going to kill me for keeping you here. But
I think I can hear. She was in there. They were eating together, so.
Okay. We'll let them have that bonding time then.
When
thinking back to your time in Indianapolis, one of the sticking points or memorable things is when you played the four. Never complained about it, at least publicly. Paul really didn't want to, and that never really worked out. And you selfishly kind of gave up your body at that four position. What was that time like for you as you – I played out of position, but excelled in doing what the team asked of you.
That was hard. It was hard for a little bit in the beginning. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. It was hard. It was harder in hindsight. In the beginning, like, that was my mindset is do whatever I'm asked to do. Like, that's my job.
Yeah.
As a teammate, like, the better I am, the better you are. The better you are, the better I am. So if they feel like this
makes us better and can possibly help me and make the team better, then there's no question. Like, it was just tougher because the league hadn't really got to that point yet. So, like, Zach Randolph came in.
A couple years early.
Like, so, like, but at the same time, like, as a leader, how can I, or as a person that want to win, how can I be asking people to buy in, standing beside me, and I won't buy in? Like, I won't do what they're asking me to do. So how am I expect the person next to me to do what they're asking him to do? Like, I can't talk to you about that if I'm defying too. I got to fix, that's the knowledge of self thing I always talk about with it. And I knew more than anything, I wanted to win. I wanted us to win. So it doesn't matter. It didn't. I mean, it did hurt a little bit later
on. Your body would disagree. Yeah.
I broke down because it was, from a selfish standpoint, it hurt because I had prepared so hard for that season to do what I had did the year before, which is play the 2-3 alongside Paul and G Hill, and I was ready for that. Like, that was the summer that Larry was in the gym the whole time with me. I was ready. I had got myself healthy. I had like a lot of ailing injuries that allowed me from getting into my peak shape the year before. And then I did it that summer. We got everything right. I stayed there for that reason, to be able to give everything I could. And it just happened to be that they needed me to give everything at that spot. And by the end of the year, I was playing it too. Like it was just, but I don't regret anything about it, because that's what we're trying to teach the game. That's what we're trying to teach. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to get the people under us to learn. You want to, anything you want to pass back, you want to further the game, and doing anything to win is a staple to keep the game integrity the way it is, especially with the way we talk about with these kids being brought up famous by the time they're 14.
That's a whole different issue. That is quite wild right now with TikTok and everything.
So I will say one thing about that.
Okay.
The biggest problem about that is that a lot of people want to be basketball players, but a lot of people don't want to play basketball.
Mm.
So meaning, yeah, obviously you know what I mean, but I'm just like, it's cool. It gets me this, it gets me that. I get free shoes, I get this. I have some natural talent, of course, to get to a certain spot, but like to play basketball, to be able to separate and to be somewhere, to be somewhere for 15 years, when there's at least 60 people coming in every year,
trying to take that job from you.
You got to play basketball. You got to breathe it. You got to eat it. You got to sleep it to a certain extent. And I don't think that a lot of them dudes want to do that, because it's not pretty.
A lot of sacrifices have to be made. And that's why I love
a lot of sacrifices.
That's the quote. Why I love the quote. I first heard JJ Redick say it, but you've never arrived. You're always becoming. And that makes me think of a lot of these guys right now. Hey, I got millions of followers. Or I even remember you. I remember the great photo Lauren tweeted out. You had so many letters from colleges. And I can't imagine what it's like for players today just being bombarded with social media.
Because you get the letters from the school, and you're getting all the people on the street that know you like they know LeBron. Like, his kids, they know like NBA players. Like,
yeah,
some of them, they know more. Honestly, there's kids you probably, if we walked in a place, They would know that kid before they knew me, for sure.
Zion, we knew on YouTube, right?
Exactly.
On a totally different note, do you think it was an advantage being left-handed? Is it an advantage being left-handed?
I think there's some advantages to it, just because of the amount. I think it plays a factor, like, in just your approach. You get so, muscle memory is a big part of sport, and I think you get caught in the way you close out, or get caught in the way you do certain things just from habit of guarding a lot of people. And it's in a scout report, and yeah, there's going to be moments you're going to be reacting, and it's not going to register. And then I don't know. I think other than that, I think it's just about understanding the game and angles. And like, the first person that I really thought, in my eyes, this is not the first person ever that I really saw that had an advantage because he was left-handed growing up, was Manu Ginobili. Like, I thought if he was right-handed, none of that stuff would have worked. Like, I felt like he was the most – he always – in the beginning, he always looked like he was falling down. He always looked like he was out of control. And then the Euro step came, and he was at the basket, or his pump fake happened. Or he just seemed like he made people so uncomfortable because it was so unorthodox. And that was the first time I thought of it in that manner. Before, I just happened to be left-handed.
Did anyone try to shame you into, no, that's the wrong way. You need to be right-handed. Did that ever happen?
Nah.
Okay.
People were more excited about it than anything, honestly.
When you were in Indiana, did you ever go to David West's house?
I did not.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I asked that because the great story he never wanted out there was it was Peyton Manning's house. And I was always curious what it was like. That's all.
Oh, I think I was told that, but I never went.
No. Okay.
Like, well, I think a real estate person slipped up and said it. But no, I never went. You know, D. West was a very to himself guy to an extent. Not like he doesn't want you around or anything, but it's just like, you know, he's very cerebral, very in touch with tries to be in touch with everything going on. So he's quiet because he's listening. He's paying attention. But when he speaks, he's one of the few people like that I'll remember forever. No matter where he was at in the arena, you heard his voice on the bench, in the locker room, you knew it was him too.
Yeah, his voice, I think, along with yours as well during that stretch, carried a lot of weight because you brought a different perspective. You don't just talk to talk. If you're going to talk, if you have something to say, is how I viewed it.
That's where I stand with it. That's the way I like to be. That's the way I feel like that's the best way to be. For me, because it allows me to have something to say when I say, because I'm paying attention to what's going on, I'm learning, I'm reading, I'm doing whatever. And if I don't know about it, how could I know about it if I'm talking during the time that people are talking about it?
Yeah. No, man, this was awesome. I really appreciate you taking time. So much ground we covered. And we wish you well getting a new job and staying back in the NBA. We want to see you back in the league, all right?
I appreciate that, man. Thank you a lot. Thank you for calling me. Thank you for the conversation. It was great. I loved it. I miss you guys in Indy, man. That's some of the best 3 years of my life. I tell people that all the time. That's not me saying it because we're on the phone. I tell everybody it felt like home, and I think that's why I was able to have the success I had there. And it never felt like I was giving up anything when I had to get asked to do stuff because I wanted to.
And it's funny because you experienced two of the quieter, dull cities as people think about, right? Salt Lake City. In Indianapolis in your career.
I was in Cleveland, too.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And then you got one of the best.
There's no disrespect to these cities. It's just compared to some other cities.
Right. Absolutely.
Like, I just don't want nobody hitting me up like, yo, I enjoyed every spot I've been in. I've learned. I've grown in all those places.
You're one to make the most of wherever your feet are, I think.
Yeah. That's what you should do. Like, if I'm too busy worried about what I could have got, did this and that, then you missed I could have been upset about a lot of things over my career that wouldn't have meant anything in the grand scheme of things. But like I think of it as I got taken to Salt Lake, I got taken to Cleveland, I got taken to Indiana, where my now wife got to be around her family, her grandmother that she wasn't getting to see, who's older for a long time, and now we down the street from her. Like all these things that were given to me through basketball, I got to experience Canada. I had a daughter who's a dual citizen. Like it's just so many things that happen. Because of this, like, life-wise, it drowns out any disappointments from little stuff of somebody talking trash to me or somebody or me missing a shot. Like, I'm going to make everyone, like, you know.
And you met Lauren in Salt Lake City, right? So there's that memory as well.
So yeah, which is wild. Like, I met her through a friend. And then I was in Salt Lake, and then all of a sudden I found out her best friend lives in Salt Lake. What are the odds of that? I don't know. But yeah, like, and then she came to visit her friend, and that was the first time in a group setting, obviously, because she didn't know me, that we got to really hang out. And from there, it's history.
That's amazing. Good stuff, man. As I said on Twitter, you always have an open invitation. We love hearing from you, so.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
What a fun conversation with CJ there. And he's a guy I certainly miss in the locker room, both watching him play, but more specifically, honestly, being one of the go-to quotes that was dependable in the locker room. Previously, over this last decade, we've really been blessed with at least one guy, it seems like, every single year. Right now, it's Justin Holliday, no doubt about it. Doug McDermott, also outstanding. In years past, we've gone from guys like Luis Scola, to David West, to Jan Mahimi, to C.J. Miles, and right now, Justin Holliday. So my thanks to C.J. for jumping on this podcast. We did this about a couple weeks before his baby daughter, his second daughter, was born. So congrats to him and Lauren on their great news and a healthy baby girl. And so that's terrific news for them. And I was glad I was able to finally get this one out. As I said at the jump, this was a podcast I recorded a month ago, the day before I was laid off by The Athletic. But this was too much of a good conversation and an important conversation. So glad I could finally share it with you. Subscribe if you haven't already to the Fieldhouse Files on all the major platforms to listen to both new and archive episodes. And I'll talk to you again soon.